What's going on, everyone? Welcome to the Davidson Hang podcast, where I get to interview amazing people and help share their wisdom with the world. Let me know your takeaways and feel free to connect with the guest. I'm aiming to build a community around coaching, self-development, leadership, where people are not afraid to be their most authentic versions of themselves. You can find us on video by searching the Davidson Hang podcast on YouTube. Welcome and enjoy the ride. Hey, what's going on, everyone? Excited to introduce you one of the most interesting guys I've ever met in my life, Aaron Fung. So I know him because he was on the board of the LinkedIn Asian Alliance, and unfortunately, he's left us to go to SAP SuccessFactors, where he is a senior HR value advisor. He's also a father. He is a big traveler, a world traveler, and has a really interesting background. So I'm excited to share with you all our conversations about coaching, and diversity, inclusion, and belonging. And yeah, I think this would be interesting for a lot of people. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks, Davidson. I appreciate you having me here today.
Yeah. Yeah, I know when we first met, who was the founder of the Kombucha Aid again?
Vanessa Du.
Yeah, that was such an awesome event. Like, you know, it's so inspiring when you see Asian entrepreneurs and clearly, you know, I drink tons of kombucha and I go to Trader Joe's a lot. So, you know, I was super excited when you were able to get here.
So. Yeah, I think it was a good way to remind people that not everyone has to go down a corporate path. And if you have the passion to create something of your own, you should go do it. And Vanessa Du is the, you know, chief revenue officer and head of sales for a very prominent kombucha company. And I think that it's a wonderful story to tell.
Yeah, it's cool to have, you know, I know the LinkedIn Asian Alliance is one of the newest ERG, right, at LinkedIn. So it's cool. Like when I joined, you know, it seemed like everything. So it's interesting to see like how that, it was all brand new, but you wouldn't have known, right? When you join an organization, it seems like Leah could have been around for, you know, so many years. So thanks for all the groundwork that you and others have put in to put, you know, to make such an awesome org.
Yeah, well, I'm sad I don't get to keep doing it at LinkedIn. Obviously, I've left LinkedIn a little bit under a year ago, but glad to hear that it's still growing and still keeping people engaged and educated.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm also, I'm really curious about your travels because I like traveling. I definitely haven't traveled to as many places as you have, but you know, what are some of the things you learned just from traveling? I mean, I'm sure there's so many that we can probably do just like a whole episode about that, but share with us like some of the more recent travels that you've done.
Yeah, I could easily talk about traveling for hours. And obviously the last 6 months of COVID-related lockdown has been hard to not be able to travel to see my family, to go on vacation. I should also say for a little bit of context that the reason why I love to travel is because my mother, before she passed away, was a travel agent. She, and actually she was not just a travel agent, she was also a paraplegic. Wow. So you have the contrast of a woman whose job it is to help people travel, but who she herself could not travel because she was disabled. And so I made her a promise about 8 or 9 years ago, which was everywhere I go in the world, I'm going to take you with me by showing you the places I eat and the people I meet and the, you know, landscapes and cities that I get to see. And so I made a promise to myself, which was to do 100 countries by my 45th birthday. Wow. And I turned 38 this past summer. I'm at 40 countries, which is not being helped by COVID-19 at all. But the last few years have definitely been particularly powerful just in terms of seeing places that I never thought I'd get to go in my lifetime. Havana, Cuba is probably what comes first to the top of my list. Oslo, Norway, and Santiago, Chile were two other like noteworthy cities that I went to over the last couple of years. And each one very different from the other, but in every place, you can always find good coffee. You can always find nice people. And more than likely, you're probably going to find something that drives you crazy. It's just about figuring out what that is, you know, once you're on the ground.
I could definitely relate to what you're saying. There's been, like, I remember when I was traveling to Colombia, there were a couple things that drove me crazy. Like when people would like try to sell me cigarettes and you would say no, and then they would still approach you 100 times later. It's like, dude, nothing has changed from 2 minutes ago. I don't like drove me crazy, but still always like it's always great learning something new when you travel. That's really cool.
Absolutely. Completely agree.
And I'm sure, your story with your mother probably has something to do with you wanting to be a coach and you having your own coaching practice as well, right? Do you think, you're like that inspired you to be able to impact and want to, dive deeper into coaching as well?
I think a lot about powerful lessons in life. I think that sometimes, they come to you, and other times you go to them. And more often than not, my mother would teach me a lot about life just by virtue of who she was and how she lived. So I think coaching is interesting because the first time I had a coach was 10 years ago in business school. I didn't know what a coach would do for me or how I would grow or benefit from it. But what I learned in those first few months of working one-on-one with an executive coach at Vanderbilt was that it takes a little bit of a shock to the system to get perspective on who you are, who you want to be, and what's stopping you. And after having a number of coaches over the last decade, I gradually began to help coach other people, mainly, alumni and current students of my business school. But it kind of naturally grew, and it became a really powerful way for people to learn about themselves. And I think most people think of a coach and they think of like basketball or gymnastics or something where someone's telling you how to do things. And that's not really what like my coaching is all about, or I think what I went through. It's much more about what can someone ask you to think about or do, and then what can you summon or I guess create for yourself. So it's that traditional, I'm not going to give you a fish, I'm going to teach you how to fish kind of moment.
As someone who's graduated from a bunch of different coaching programs as well, I think it starts with the inner journey, right? I think that's how a lot of us getting to coaching. For me, I realized like, okay, like my life is not where I wanted to be, and I was like, all right, let me do something about it instead of being a victim and like repeating the same things and expecting a different result. Of course, meeting all these amazing people who are coaches, you start to see, huh, like what are they doing differently? So that's how I got into it. But I love what you said about teaching someone how to fish, right? It's so much more valuable when you develop the right structures and processes and have the right habits instead of someone doing it for you. And I mean, I think there's a time and a place for that. Like I think leverage is important. But at the foundation, at the core, right? If you can be able to have awareness around some of your automatics, then it's more empowering, like if you're able to see your blind spots and do something about it.
Completely agree. And I think that certainly there are, like you said, there are times to be dependent or codependent, but many times it's important to have self-sufficiency, especially when it comes to making decisions that affect yourself and people around you.
Yeah, which is like everything, right? Like we often are so automatic about things that we don't take a step back and realize the impact that we're having, right? Even when you become a father or you don't realize how like they're all sponges, right? Everyone around you like really takes in. So it's like more about who you're being versus like the doing aspects a lot of
So true, very true.
times. And so you seem to be very involved within the Asian community as well. Were you always involved at a young age? Like what made you really want to spend so much time help in the Asian communities?
I remember being, I think, a sophomore or junior in college, and I went to a liberal arts college in Tacoma, Washington, the University of Puget Sound. And I remember joining the board of the Asian Pacific American Student Union. There wasn't a particularly large Asian population at my school, and it was kind of a jarring contrast because I'm from San Francisco, where the population is incredibly vibrant and diverse, at least for Asian Americans. And I think ever since then, I've always kind of found ways to get involved with the community. I've done certainly less from a community service perspective than I would like. But when I graduated from college, started working, one of the first organizations I got involved with is Ascend. And for those who haven't heard of it, Ascend is a nonprofit that's focused on developing Pan-Asian business leaders in corporate America. So for me, it was interesting to talk to people who were in different jobs or industries, particularly in, you know, accounting and finance at that time, and discovering that there were all these common issues around, gosh, you know, a lot of Asian folks get into certain jobs, but don't rise to the top of their respective organizations. Why? What are the challenges from a behavior perspective or an expectation perspective that maybe run counter to certain expectations in the business world? And that's kind of where I started to learn about what exactly corporate advancement is like, you know, what institutional roadblocks are there, what cultural roadblocks are there, and how can I basically get rid of as many lame excuses as possible. People who don't speak up or are more meek in conversation. Like, I've never been accused of being meek. So it's an interesting, you know, set of conversations when people talk about challenges that they face that they perceive and holding them back in their career.
How much do you think of that as like a self-fulfilling prophecy? Because I think we often find like confirmation bias, right? So I think for me, sometimes it's like I'm almost seeking people who are like myself. So I can even surround myself with all these other Asian people who don't speak up, who don't like conflict, who, you know, stay in their own lane, just work, put your head down, work hard, and, you know, the results will speak for itself.
I think it's always hard to quantify, but I think that your point is totally valid. I think we all tend to seek sort of safety in numbers or people who look or sound or act like us. I actually have come to a realization over the last few months of working with a coach myself, which is that I like to seek out difference. When I lived in Manhattan, it was probably the most stimulating environment ever because everyone is so different, right? The guy who would sell me coffee in the mornings was from Afghanistan. You know, I'd walk by a Jewish deli. You know, I would meet people from all parts of the United States, from Europe, from Africa, from Latin America, and I thrived on difference, whereas I think a lot of people are scared of difference and would prefer to be in an environment where people say the same things or speak the same language. And, you know, that may work for some people most of their lives, but for me, it doesn't work. Like, I think that I need to be surrounded by difference, whether that's racial or ethnic or age or background, because that's what truly I find interesting as compared to everyone who looks the same or acts the same.
I know everyone has different boundaries and everyone has different comfort zones. You know, the fact that you've traveled so much, and I mean, and it's interesting, right? With the election coming up, like, you know, there's a lot of conversations about, it's interesting to see, like, when we go so far in one direction, like, you know, we had our first Black president, right? And then we go completely the opposite way, right? How does one act around people that have boundaries that are not as progressive, right? Because, you know, like, I know for me, like, I tend to try to surround myself with a lot of different opinions and different ethnicities, different backgrounds, but not everyone is the same, right? Like, some people, you know, it takes longer for them to kind of get outside their comfort zone.
I mean, I think it's important to think about what you can control and influence and what you can't change. You know, and certainly you can influence other people's, you know, beliefs or ideas, but at the end of the day, you can't control anyone else outside of yourself. So, you know, how do you keep an open mind? How do you listen and acknowledge and compassionately understand what someone else is going through? You know, I encourage anyone, regardless of political belief or exposure to people of difference right now, to just even take a listen to anything on the other side and see, is any part of that reasonable? You know, and I think that applies certainly to what you do for work, the kind of groups you surround yourself with. And you know, I fully acknowledge that, you know, where I grew up, where I live, it, you know, has not always been the most, you know, vibrantly diverse areas. Like, San Francisco has diversity, but not in equal measure and not in every group. Mm-hmm. You know, I moved to Chicago 2 years ago, and now I live on the North Shore of Chicago, which is even less diverse than Chicago itself. So certainly less racial and ethnic diversity than I would like here. But I think at the end of the day, you have to find ways to be able to find people who you can learn from and have those conversations. And the last 6 months, I think, has proven a lot of that. Like, you can have meaningful, deep conversations with people who are very different from you, so long as you keep an open mind and you're willing to hear people out.
Hmm. Yeah, I know with you, you thrive off of conflict, right? Like, I know there's certain people who they see conflict as a way of learning, of growth, as a way of seeing different perspectives, different opinions, right? How does someone embrace that instead of run away from it? Because I do think humans innately, because of our fight or flight modes, we try to run away from conflict. But it seems like with you, you're able to really embrace it and be able to learn and grow from it.
Well, and I should clarify, I don't thrive off conflict. I don't enjoy picking fights with everybody, despite what my wife might say or anyone else might say. But I do recognize that there is a value in constructive confrontation or conflict, which is, if you don't confront someone and then later on you feel regret for having not stood up for yourself or someone else, like, well, you actually could have changed the way you represented yourself or protected someone else or made sure someone knew what they were doing, maybe didn't have the actual result that they intended. And the way I like to frame it is that if I didn't care about it or you, I wouldn't tell you. The fact that I care about it or you means I want you to know about that. And by the way, who am I serving if I just keep my mouth shut while something bad happens? And, you know, do I recommend people pick fights arbitrarily? No, please don't do that. There's no need in the world for unnecessary conflict. Right. You know, but I think it's a particularly big issue now because you hear about situations in which, you know, someone's being bullied or someone is being taken advantage of and no one around them says anything. And certainly I've discovered in my life more recently that between fight or flight, I tend to fight. But I think it's important for people to figure out, you know, what's going to actually help you get the outcome you want. You know, if someone says, I'm not going to give you a promotion even though you earned it, are you going to run away from that conflict or are you going to stand up for what you think you deserve? It's your choice, but the end result is if you are not getting what you feel you deserve and all you just do is harbor all that resentment, like, who's served by that? Certainly not you.
That's interesting because I do see many instances where people will leave a company in hopes of getting promoted at a different company, right? So there's that, the flight portion of the fight or flight where it's like, well, if I can't get promoted here, I'm going to go somewhere else and find it, right? But in a way, we're not dealing with the same thing will come up as when we go to a different company, right? So in a way...
It could, but here's the thing. That situation you just mentioned could also be fight. Your fight could be, I'm not going to put up with what I'm being given anymore or what my situation is, and I'm going to fight to make it what I want it. Right. You know, and certainly some people do flee from one problem to another problem at a different organization, but I think it always is dependent on the individual and the situation they're in.
This is an interesting conversation because I would say I'm a recovering people pleaser, right? I think, you know, my natural instinct is just to help the world, right? But sometimes I put others request before my own. So it's like, I need to, you know, at least focus on my core. And it comes from a place of like, just wanting to fit in, right? Wanting to be accepted. But it's interesting because it usually doesn't serve me, right? I mean, I think sometimes it serves me, right? Like I have a lot of friends, I have a lot of LinkedIn connections, right? But at the end of the day, there's some days where I'm exhausted and it's like, huh, like it's probably because like, I'm not setting enough boundaries to be able to like have respect, like, hey, like this is important to me and just focus on that versus like fulfilling other people's like goals and intentions and agendas.
Well, and it's always a gray area, right? It's not clear cut in a lot of situations where the line is when someone is taking more than giving or when you're taking more than giving or vice versa. So the inevitable question is, well, do you wish you'd done something different? Okay. Well, what person do you need to become to actually do that in future? Does that mean you have to always argue? No. But could you challenge more directly or indirectly? Always. How? I mean, that's the million-dollar question, right? Is it something you have to learn how to do? Is it something you can practice? Is it something that only can be earned through real situations? Like, and this is where, you know, you and I have both been in sales for a long time. It's where some people sometimes will think that you can just study something and learn how to do it. And not everything can be studied in a book. Sometimes you need to be doing things in person, running through the mistakes, losing a deal, saying the wrong thing, so that you know, don't ever say that again. Don't ever do that again, because, you know, that doesn't help the mission or the goal at hand.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think for me, you know, I like reflecting back on where I've learned the most, like the times, like the things that I was always afraid of, like standing up for myself, or, you know, like promoting myself or advocating for myself. I think that's a skill that is so valuable nowadays. And I think, I don't know about you, but, you know, a lot of like the traditional, like Chinese families, or like a lot of relatives I know, like, you know, you're not supposed to talk back to your elders. Like, you're not supposed to challenge authority, right? Whether that looks like your manager or your director or VP or whoever it is, right? So I see it, you know, a lot of times, even being in sales, right? Just the fact that you're like selling for a living, you know, a lot of like Asians, you know, like that's not what your parents will tell you. It's like, oh, you should be a professional salesperson as your career, right? So it's interesting being Asian and like seeing how that influences, and always, you know, looking around and seeing on your team, like you always being one of the very few Asians a lot of times, at least for me.
Yeah, and it's funny, coming back to that point of constructive conflict, I've actually found moments in which I challenged the other side, whether it was a client or a manager or someone else who was in a more senior or authoritative position, it actually earned me more respect. Mm-hmm. Because I was not going to just simply fall in line or just going to agree with them for agreement's sake. You know, there's one customer who said, you know, I don't think you guys have this ability to do this. And I said, respectfully, I disagree. And the reason why I know that is I have the data to prove it. And if you give me a chance, I can actually show you that your idea is incorrect. It's actually the opposite. And she said, that's great. I had no clue. Thank you. And so I think it all depends on the how, right? It's not just that you're confronting people for like confrontation's sake. It's, well, what are you actually getting to? Did you respect them in the process? You know, did they cross a line which they were unaware of or they were aware of? I think all these questions kind of naturally play into it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think one of the most valuable things you can do as a consultant, as a, you know, in sales or anyone who's an advisor, is challenge preconceived notions, right? Preconceived beliefs, right? If they've been doing something forever, like, yes, it got you to where you are, but maybe if you tried this thing or if you implemented a new solution, you would get even better results, right? So, you know, that's such a valuable skill to have.
And I think at the core of that, which is, I think, a skill that everyone needs to work on, is how do you ask powerful questions? You know, whether it's in coaching or sales or hell, even becoming just friendly with people, like, do you ask them the right question? And this is an interesting cultural contrast example, but in San Francisco, one of the questions that everyone asks each other when they're first getting to know people is, what do you do? Which implies, what is your job? And that question does not come up as often in the Midwest. And of course, my Midwestern wife, who grew up in Wisconsin, and I have had long discussions on this, but it's like, well, what is the goal of that question? In San Francisco, it's to ascertain your social capital, the importance, the recognition that you have, the success that you may have had. Oh, I work at Google or I work at LinkedIn. In the Midwest, that's not as important. So you might say, hey, where'd you grow up? Uh-huh. Or, you know, tell me more about, you know, how you guys found this couple or found this restaurant. And so the nature of a question, I think, is incredibly important, because when you ask a question that is meaningful, people take note, even if they can't answer. And, you know, I cheekily put on my LinkedIn profile that my job in coaching is not as a coach, but as a brain wrinkler, because if I can ask you a question that you can't answer, I have put a wrinkle in your brain. And your ability now to answer that question, which you couldn't answer before, puts another wrinkle in that brain. So that's why I encourage people, like, when you're selling, when you're meeting people, put a wrinkle in their brain. How? Go figure it out. Try something. You know, like, don't be like, what do you do? Come on, give me something else. Give me something meaningful.
Yeah, you're right, right? Because, I mean, most people, you know, when you're asked that question, you're just like, okay, this guy just wants to like put me in a box, or wants to, you know, like networking purposes. Oh, he's probably evaluating, oh, can this guy do something for me? Or can he be a valuable to me, right? Whether it's like finding investors or, you know, like trying to get ahead in life. So yeah, that's That is annoying, right? I think the people that open with that, you're already kind of like, if you're just like, okay, like, you know, but whereas if someone's just as curious and, you know, says something else to try to get to know you on a deeper level, it's a much more impactful relationship right from the get-go.
Yeah, always, absolutely.
And so it sounds like you've been pretty involved with Ascend. What are some of the takeaways from just being highly involved with Ascend and a lot of these? Because I do go to a lot of these events, and sometimes I feel like the conversations are similar, right? But, you know, sometimes I'm like, okay, is anything productive coming out of these conversations, right? Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And certainly there are plenty of Asian nonprofits or you know, social organizations that people can be a part of, which I encourage people to go be involved in whatever's available to you. You know, when I think about what a place like Ascend does for me or did for me, it's an opportunity for you to practice some of the things that you may be asked to do in your career in a non-risk, low-risk environment. Like if I lead a team or if I'm on the board of the Midwest chapter, so you know, if I wanted more experience in how to manage a team of volunteers, which could be, you know, translatable to managing a team in my day job, that could be really relevant. And again, what, you know, if you're leading a group of 10 accomplished professionals and, you know, they give you feedback on how you direct or inspire them, you know, it provides you free feedback, which again, can only serve to improve your position in life. Now, as a member, right, I look at it when I first joined the organization in 2006, I just wanted to network with people and build my connections within the community, which I did. It was not just super senior people within finance and accounting, but it was also people my age, the same career stage. And from that journey, I built some of the best friends of my life because we've been in very different worlds, but we've had kind of parallel stories. And I found that over the last decade, those contacts, even the weak ties, were just amazing to have had a connection with, because I might say, oh, I know this person at this company we're trying to sell into, or that I'm currently on a consulting project at. Maybe I'll ping them and see if I get some perspective. I had one customer, which was a healthcare organization in LA when I was at LinkedIn. And it just happened that one of the people I knew from, you know, just social connections was a nurse at that hospital. And so, of course, I said, hey, can I bug you for half an hour, just hear about your experience in the organization, what makes it attractive, like why did you come there, because you could have gone anywhere, what's kept you there? And so when I eventually made the presentation to their head of talent acquisition, I said, well, here's a story around one of your nurses, you know, who's a big fan of this training and development program that you have. She said, how do you know that? I said, because one of my friends is a nurse here. So, I mean, it provides opportunities like that, which, you know, in selling, in any kind of relationship-driven business, which I would say is pretty much every business, can be super valuable, even if it's one small observation from one person who doesn't have seniority. So even though everyone around you might be a senior associate and not a partner, well, more than likely, someone's going to be a senior leader in that group at some point in your career. Does that mean you're constantly having to bombard? It's like, hey, it's been 2 weeks since I talked to you. How are you? Hey, it's been 2 more weeks. Like, no. Don't be weird. that should be a common sense thing, but I'll say it out loud. But, you know, find ways to grow those connections organically, and then you'll have a really wonderful network, regardless of what you choose to go do later on.
So it sounds like networking and learning different perspectives has obviously served you in your career. What if, because one of the things I hear about people is, like, oh, I don't want to bother him. Or, oh, I don't want to bother her. You know, they're afraid of reaching out to you know, higher ups because
sure.
They think they don't have the bandwidth to talk to them. Like, what advice would you give to people who are a little bit more introverted and are afraid of taking that first step?
I give a question. How do you know that you're busy to talk to you? Of course, the answer is always, well, I don't know. Like, so you're assuming.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Okay. What if I told you that not only was that leader willing to talk to you, but that you would distinguish yourself by making that ask? Would you ask? Of course. And how are you going to know until you ask? I mean, some people might say you're just talking to them in circles. Like, no, I'm not. I'm actually attempting to circumvent their superego, their inner critic, that part of their psyche that's attempting to keep them safe. What if they say no? They say no. That's not the worst thing in life. On the list of the worst things in life, getting COVID-19, seeing a parent die, getting struck by lightning, getting cancer. Take your pick. There are plenty of terrible things. I do not understand how people can be afraid of getting rejected from a conversation and have it be the worst thing in their life. Now, do I recognize that not everyone is extroverted? Absolutely. But you don't have to be an extrovert to ask someone for their time. In fact, if anything, extroversion has nothing to do with it, because that's where you regain your strength, not in your inherent behavior.
Mm.
You can be a classic introvert, ask someone for time one-on-one, go talk with them one-on-one, and then take your time to recover by yourself. It has nothing to do with your introversion or extroversion. It has all to do with your fear of getting rejected, which unfortunately prevents a lot of people from activating a connection, a mentor relationship, hell, even just a good set of perspectives from someone who's been in a different place.
That's so true. So many takeaways there. I think many people like double down on the extrovert thing as an excuse or as a way not to take as many risks, right? We're like, well, I'm an introvert. I would never be able to do that.
Can I swear on this podcast, or should I keep it PG?
Yeah, I'm just fine.
That's bullshit. I mean, that's such bullshit. Like, I don't understand how people are like, oh, well, you know, I'm an introvert. Yeah, so? I mean, that's an excuse and a pretty lame one. And I mean, if you want me to try to talk you out of it, I can. But if you don't want to do this and you don't want to advance your career, that's your choice. It's up to you. I mean, if you don't want to talk to anybody, gain knowledge, and do it all on your own, could you still be successful? Maybe. Not likely, though, if you don't have any understanding of where the risks come from, where the guardrails are, who is who does what. Like, if you don't know any of that, how would you ever expect to be competitive with other people who are smart as you, but have that?
Mm. Yeah, I like what you said about it's a choice. I think many of us say like, oh, well, I don't do that because X, Y, Z, right? There's always a rationale behind some of our actions.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I see that we're using so many, like every excuse in the book not to do that, not to make those hard. I mean, not even hard, but not to do something that's uncomfortable. Like, I think a lot of people are afraid of putting themselves out there.
And that's where that, you know, the inevitable question is, what's the worst that could happen to you? Oh, they might say no. Please tell me how them saying no to you is the worst thing that could happen, or the worst thing that could ever happen to you in your life. Go ahead. And of course, then someone will then say, well, it's not the worst thing ever. You're right. It isn't.
Yeah.
And it's a mentality, like, which, I mean, I started my career in sales, but I did very poorly because I was paralyzed by rejection. And I also did not fully, I think, buy into the product I was selling, which is wealth management. So that's a complicating factor. But if you're going to sell anything, you either have to believe in it or come across like you believe in it. That's it.
I like what you said about paralyzed by rejection. It's crazy to think that more people, statistically speaking, are afraid of public speaking than death itself, right? Like, to me, that's mind-blowing. And to your point, it's because of the fear of rejection. Like, what if I get on stage, even if it's 10 people, and someone doesn't like me, but, you know, they think what I have to say isn't valuable, or, you know, they fall asleep or something like that, right? It's fascinating to think that that's the most common fear in the world.
And by the way, it's to be expected. Not everyone is going to love what you have to say. If that was the case, we would be basically clones of one another. We would have no difference, no perspective. We would all be the same, which to me personally would be the worst kind of world, where everyone's identical, right? It's like the Matrix. And we're all plugged into machines, you know, with big wires sticking in the back of our heads. That exact example, too, I think is also really connected to me, because I remember, as I grew up from age 6 to like age 14, I was on the stage a lot doing plays and musicals and musical theater. So I got used to being the center of attention when I would perform. And when I got to high school, I would do speaking at my all school meetings because I was the president of a club and I had to get up there to get people to come to my club events. And it is terrifying, right? There's that pit in your stomach that just jumps up into your throat because there are, you know, hundreds of people looking at you. And that's where, like, well, okay, what's the worst that could happen to you? Yes, you could say something wrong or trip over yourself, but it's like, again, that's not the worst thing in the world. And by the way, if you practice enough, it doesn't become as daunting because you have confidence in it. Like, how do some of the best actors and comedians do well? I mean, I'm sure some of them were very much afraid of the stage. But the more you do something, the more comfortable you get. The more comfortable you get, the better you do. Works for sales pitches, works for any amazing comedian who's out there, or an actor. Why can't it work for you?
Oh, yeah. I saw that you're also a comedian as well. Who are some of your favorite? Who's your favorite comedian now? And what have you learned from that comedian?
I should clarify that I was an attempted comedian about 14 years ago. I did do some attempts at stand up in San Francisco, which I greatly enjoyed. And honestly, I don't know why I never even pursued it like as a real deal. My claim to fame is that I went to high school with Ali Wong. She was in my class.
Wow.
You know, she's very funny. But I unfortunately have to say she's not my favorite comedian, just because there are other people's just styles who I think really, really resonate with me. I do like some of Louis C.K.'s work, and I do realize that unfortunately he's fallen from grace a little bit, which is unfortunate. You know, Jim Jefferies, the Australian comedian, has some really wonderful bits. And I like when someone is very clever, but also has a really just good set of subject matters that really bring out you know, a rise out of me. So, I mean, I love comedy in all forms. I love to go to comedy clubs. And once this whole situation is resolved, I will look forward to going back to that. But yeah, that's just a couple of people I'm thinking about.
My favorite comedians are the ones that do impressions like spot.
Oh, yeah. Ari Spears does some amazing impersonations who I deeply love. I mean, it's like whenever I hear impersonations, I appreciate accents. I appreciate imitation. Like, it just makes me very happy.
Yeah, and you can tell that comedians are such a good study of the human condition and the human characters.
Oh yeah,
it's like to be able to like understand someone that well and the little tics and the little nuances, like to me it's fascinating. I'm like, man, how were you able to like truly get to the essence so perfectly? I don't know, to me it's like it's so cool to see people that do that. It's an art.
Well, you know, and I think that it's everyone finds something different funny. And that's the one thing I remember from my comedy training program. Like, it was like, truth is funny. So you can't tell someone else's jokes because it's not your truth. You know, like if you start to do Seinfeld's jokes, it's not funny because first of all, they're Seinfeld's jokes and you've just ripped someone off. Two, that's not your experience because you probably were not living his life.
Yeah.
And every comedian will have something that works really well for them, because that's their truth.
Yeah. I've never thought of it that way. I mean, it makes sense, like, you know, now that you're thinking about it. But yeah, that's why I think I resonate with Asian comedians typically more, because like, you know, when they talk about their parents or like the ridiculous stuff that like, you know, I'm always like, oh my God, that's hilarious. But yeah, that's.
Well, there's a good example of this too. I don't know how many folks out there have watched The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel on Amazon Prime, which is a hilarious show, wonderfully written, very witty. But at one point early on in her career, she pays a guy to write jokes for her. And he puts them on like index cards. The problem is there are jokes he writes for everybody. They're all the same jokes and they're not funny.
Yeah.
And she completely bombs on stage. And I remember seeing this so when I was doing this comedy college in San Francisco, you can do an open mic night. And the guy who went ahead of me was trying to tell jokes like he'd been in jail and served time. And he was like this really scrawny, nerdy guy. Like he clearly looked like your typical software engineer. I'm like, there's no way you have gone to jail and served time. And I'm like, but why would you crack those jokes? Like, that's not funny.
Yeah.
It's not you, you know? I mean, so that has become a fundamental precept of my life, which is you got to tell your story. Your story works. I mean, you could tell other people's stories, but you know, prepare yourself for different reactions.
Yeah, it's so cool to see that the best comedians are the ones that like make fun of their lives so much that you're like, oh my, you know, but it's so raw, so authentic, it's so real.
Yeah,
like for me, when I listen to Kevin Hart, you know, or Aziz, when he talks about his dating life, like you're just like, this is hilarious. Cause you know that he, you know, he's gone through a lot, like all of that. And it's hilarious.
Well, and you know, Aziz Ansari is a great example, right? Goes to NYU, gets a business degree. He's from South Carolina and he's always talking about his upbringing, you know, being, you know, brown and growing up in South Carolina. And, you know, that's again, it's their story. you can choose to laugh at it or not, but at the end of the day, the only thing that's promised is that it's their story.
Yeah. This is the, it's funny because I think we don't often take the time to really like embrace our story, right? I think a lot of us kind of go about life and we don't really pause to kind of reflect to be like, how do I purposely, like, who do I purposely want to be for the world, right? A lot of us is like, oh, I get this job because it looks good on paper, or like, oh, you know, my parents will be happy, or, oh, I'm doing this because that's just what people do. But I think many of us don't truly take the time to like really like own our story and even make fun of it too, because I think there's a lot of value in that too, so that you don't take yourself so seriously.
Yeah. Well, and you know, so many people will go do something because that's what's expected or what society says you should do. And you know, I had those moments in my life, especially coming out of business school, like saying, oh, I have to do this or I should do this. And over the last few years, I've realized that you shouldn't do what everyone else expects of you just because they expect it of you. If that's actually what you want to do, of course, go do it. You know, I mean, I went from working in banking to consulting to tech. Like I followed like some of the most like traditional paths for post MBA education. But the reasons for my changes were because I was finding out slowly what I wanted to do in life. I went into banking because it was a paycheck. And in retrospect, it was a terrible decision, which I've told everyone, like, that's my mistake. I picked the wrong path. Mm-hmm. Consulting was a wonderful educational experience, but I also had challenges in the environment because I couldn't do projects related to talent all the time, which is the stuff I loved. So when I got to LinkedIn, it was an evolution of what I loved, what I'd studied, what I'd wanted to do. And it got me to a place where I could actually do that all the time, you know, and you know, ultimately solve problems for people instead of just, you know, putting in long hours and billing them, you know, like I would do in consulting. So I think for everybody, like there should be an important set of questions asked early on, not just when you graduate, but before you graduate. What are the activities that bring you the most joy? I mean, I really love the thrill of competition, the pursuit of something that seems out of range, and ultimately solving a problem. So yeah, sales is probably a good place to consider, maybe not forever, but at least to start with based on just that acknowledgement of your characteristics. If you said, I really thrive on, you know, doing my own work by myself and putting things together where there was nothing before, you know, and I'm a highly analytical and quantitative person, engineering, computer science, product management. I mean, gosh, like, yeah, certain things just naturally fit, but you can't know that until you've asked someone what that's like, or even acknowledge like what you bring to the table.
That's good awareness. And it's cool too, because you went through banking and then you went through consulting, you appreciate what you have more, right? Because you've gone through that, you can say, okay, I've tried it. Wasn't my cup of tea, instead of people that haven't tried it, and then they're still like, oh, I wonder what would have happened if I got into banking or if I got into consulting, right? So in a way, you know, it worked out.
Perspective is very expensive. You know, I think people, and I mean, hell, even a place like LinkedIn, which I love, right? There were people who, that was their first job. They came to expect free food, delivered delicious all the time, you know, all these things where you get taken care of. And of course, I would laugh at those people and I would call them out and say, you have no clue what the real world's all about. You live a privileged life, which is incredible. And I love it too. However, that is not the norm for so many people. So you got to get off your high horse and thinking like this is the way it's supposed to be, because it's not. And you are just very lucky.
Yeah, I meet tons of LinkedIners that it's their only job that they've ever had. And then I'm like, dude, you have no idea what it's like, man. I've had 14 other jobs. Like, you know, I can tell you that you're very fortunate right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell that to someone too, you know, like unless you go through that. But I like what you said about perspective is expensive. That's funny. I'm going to have to use that one.
Well, and it's, I would actually like challenge, I'd say it's not hard to tell people that. It's hard for them to learn it. Right. Like I can tell someone directly, like, you have no effing clue what you're talking about. They might just think I'm an ass and just walk away from that. The reality is they don't have any perspective if that's the only thing they've known. Like that is the definition of no alternative perspective. And that's something that I've come to appreciate, especially over the last 5 years, is where can I gain perspective? Someone who's different than me.
I love that. And then this is a question that a lot of people probably ask you too, and I think it's good to for people to, how do you know when to leave a company like a LinkedIn that's super well known, that's, you know, it's such a great culture, and to go into something? I mean, obviously you joined another great company, but because I do know a lot of people that, you know, they're just, they're comfortable and they're like, oh, I know everyone, I'm doing well, I'm getting paid well. Like, how does one know when to make that jump?
There's no easy way to answer this, so I'll do my best. The concept that I bring up in coaching all the time is resonance, which is when something works, it's resonant. If you play an instrument, you know what resonance is. Like, when chords are in harmony, things sound good. When they're not, it makes you cringe. You're like, oh, something sounds wrong. That sensation is exactly what I tell people to look for, either the resonance or the dissonance. What that resonance or dissonance is coming from, you have to identify. I had that my first year and a half at LinkedIn because I had a lot of variety of activity. I covered a large number of customers. I covered a large sales group. I got to travel. I had some good wins. I got to bring my knowledge and insight from the talent world to customers who are not the biggest customers of LinkedIn. It's a great experience, right? By the end, I needed to change for a variety of reasons, right? And that those dissonant moments were becoming louder than the resonant moments. And so when people work with me from a coaching perspective, part of it is they're trying to get to a decision around, well, where do I go next or what do I do? I'm like, you can't actually answer that question until you know the places where you are resonant or where you are dissonant. The first time I ever asked myself, like, where are the good moments in my career where I've done well, loved my job, and felt deeply fulfilled? They were always moments of education and teaching. So building learning and development programs for Merrill Lynch, doing programs like that at Ascend, hell, even rebuilding the onboarding program for my first job out of business school at Credit Suisse, they were all experiments, projects, or experiences that taught me a ton about, I love educating people. But what you do with that is, like, I could have gone and become a school teacher, but, you know, I realized that our school districts are terribly underfunded, and, you know, my student loans from business school were not going to be paid off by being a high school English teacher or a grade school math teacher. So again, you have to balance a few different things that are important within that context, right? And what you do with your career is absolutely up to you, and certainly involves a little bit of external influence, like what you're trying to do, what skills you have, what prerequisites you do or don't have. But that's where I encourage everyone, think about what you resonate with or don't before you even make any career moves.
Yeah, I love what you said about resonance and dissonance. I don't think many of us, or sometimes we justify it. We're like, well, it pays the bills, or well, you know, this will help me pay off my student loans. And then we wake up one day and then we're like, man, I can't believe I did 30 years of this and I hated it.
Yeah. And by the way, you know what pays the bills? Slinging drugs, you know, being a gun for hire, kidnapping and extortion. Technically, to some people, that pays the bills. Terribly risky. I don't know if it does that well for you from a reputation perspective, right? And there's a, you know, the chance you'll get shot or arrested. But I think, again, like, that's a rationale of someone who doesn't understand what they actually value. And I don't mean just like, oh, money. Like, sure, I appreciate money just like any other fan of capitalism and you know, someone who wants to pay their bills. But what does that money, for example, really represent? Oh, it's self-reliance and autonomy. It's not having to worry about the next month's rent check. It's about feeling safe. That's a way different sensation or realization than saying, oh, I just value money.
Yeah, that's a deep conversation. I look at what you said about, because it looks different for everyone, right? But I think many of us don't go past the surface, right? Many of us, like, you know, I think people that have kids, like people that have families, yes, you know, you've done some of that work. But I think many of us, if you ask them point blank, they don't know what the money represents, right? So yeah, this has been a really insightful conversation, Aaron. Definitely I'd love to have you back on the podcast. And cool. Where can people reach out to you?
You can always find me on LinkedIn, Aaron Fung. Hopefully there aren't that many Aaron Fungs. You can find me on my website. It's www.coachingaf.com. People ask me very cheekily, like, did you create that knowing millennials would like it? I'm like, Yeah, but my initials are also AF. So whenever I talk to a non-millennial client, they're like, oh, that's your initials. I'm like, yes, that is correct. So yeah, you can find me at Aaron@coachingaf.com if you want to email me or find me on LinkedIn.
Cool. I'll link to your profile. And yeah, thanks for your time, Aaron.
Likewise. Thanks for having me on.
Well, that's it, folks. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Please subscribe and let me know what your thoughts are, if there were any takeaways. I welcome all positive and constructive feedback and hope you enjoy. Stay tuned for more interesting stories and guests. Take care.